Yeah, it was quite a lineup we had this year.
And it got incredible national coverage. I had so many people in California come to me and mention that they had seen it. And I think it's taken seriously around the country. And just given the nature of the politicians who make the decision to come, you know, I mean, they must really think that it's worthwhile in some of it. Because I think most of their decisions are politically self-motivated and politically driven.
It's pretty impressive who shows up here.
Yeah.
Now, that party happened at Zolman's, right?
Yes.
Tell me about Zolman's.
Zolman's was great, and I think that you can mention Zolman's to any WNL alumnus, and they'll just kind of smile, you know, and remember being out there. It's that simple structure. It's wood. I wonder if it's a fire hazard, you know, or some other sort of hazard. It's fallen apart. And it's just, I think, a wonderful layout for these sort of functions. And whether it's daytime functions with the river running through the grassy area, or nighttime where you can put a band up there and everybody can be encompassed in this great little warm cabin-like atmosphere, it was just always a good time. And the hardest part is getting all the way out there. But it's a very nostalgic sort of place, I think, for WNL graduates and faculty alike, and I know they held a lot of alumni functions out there still. And I just think it represents kind of the simplicity, the easy way of life that we all appreciate about WNL. And we would go out there sometimes on Easter. I can remember getting 20, 30 people and going out there and just throwing the ball around. And some people would be laying in the river, enjoying the water coming over their feet. And you'd have some people throwing a little cross ball. And other people have gone for a walk along the river and hike. And other people sleep in the grass, you know. And it just was just kind of the sort of place you'd love to get back to every once in a while to relax and get your wits about you. I love Zolman's.
How about other places in the countryside?
There were, one of the beautiful things about WNL were the country homes that we all lived in. And of course it was always men living in these homes before women got here. And I don't think women could have lived in those homes. And I don't think the mothers of the boys were ever allowed to see those homes, because they would have been appalled. You know, and I think most of them had running water, but I'm not sure that they all did. I know a lot of them didn't have heat, but it was just the country life. And, you know, everybody had hardwood floors and big rooms and high ceilings and fireplaces. And you would just go out to these homes after your day, you know, in school and relax. And a lot of people had dogs that were running around, and a lot of people had land where they were able to go hunting and fishing on the land. And for a college student, it was just the good life. I can remember a friend inviting me over to have quail with him. He had shot it and we cooked it up and ate it. And women began to infiltrate into country homes, but I think that they were country homes that had been family homes, and for some reason maybe had just, you know, been lowered to the threshold that now it was ready for college students. But my senior year, there were four of us in a home, and we had a back deck. We were right on the river. We had a big patio overlooking the river. We had fireplaces in every bedroom. Mm-hmm. We had hardwood floors and just beautiful detail all over the house. And I can remember we bargained the landowner down to $175 a month for rent, which just makes you cringe now, you know, to think about it. And we entertained out there, and we had a pig roast for somebody's birthday one time. And it was just the life. And I think definitely adds to the charm, the nostalgia, you know, the wonderful lifestyle that we experienced.
How about Goshen? Did you ever go out to Goshen?
Did go out to Goshen, although I will say that there was a big flood my sophomore year, and it tore down the bridge that goes out to Goshen, so that became an issue. But Goshen, when organized well, was always just so fun, and there were so many other people out there, and whether it was just lying on the rocks and relaxing or inner tubing all the way down, you know, it's the sort of things now that are just so hard to find the time to enjoy.
Did you ever tube all the way into town?
No, I never came all the way into town. And I just did, I think there was a typical stint that took about an hour for everybody to do. And I always get really nervous right before we did it because it's a little scary, you know. And maybe that's a woman speaking. I think the men approached it recklessly, like they are invincible. But it was scary, but you finished and it was just so fun. And then lying on the rocks, and there was always quality time and spending time with friends. And it was just God, another great component about how wonderful the lifestyle was here. And I think now in California I have opportunities to do these things, and it's one of the reasons why I continue to enjoy California so much, is we have so much at our fingertips, and we did here too. We just, sometimes I think you didn't have the energy of the organization to really tap into it as much as you should have.
Well, speaking of organizations, did you get involved in extracurricular stuff?
I was involved. I was pretty involved. I was a member of the first women's soccer team. And being in a class of 100 women made it easy. Being in a class of 400 freshmen made it easy, and in 1,600 students made it easy. It seemed everybody I knew was involved in multiple different things. And I think it was the culture, and I think it's the way maybe we all were within our families and our communities outside of WNL too, and it just all kind of continued to flow. But I was on the soccer team. I'd never played lacrosse before, and we had a women's lacrosse team start up, and we were club for a couple years, and I played on that. And because it wasn't very competitive, I was able to do that, and I'm not sure now I'd be able to play on that team. But I got involved in the Cathicon group, which is the liaisons between the student and the alumni, and I think just involved in affairs beyond what the average college student would see or think about. And I was, as I mentioned, involved in the mock convention. I mean, it just seemed like if you didn't have something that you were working on beyond your schoolwork and your social life, then there was a little lull, you know, until something else came up. And everybody that I knew was involved like that. As I told you, my good friend ran Fancy Dress, and, you know, another friend started up some sort of art, you know, organization where just, I don't know, there was always a lot going on, and a lot of opportunity to start new things all the time, which was maybe the nice part about a school that had just admitted women that might have some new ideas about some new organizations that benefit the school.
Do you think the administration was a little more open-minded than
the students?
Yeah, or than... Tell me about the administration while you were here.
I was surprised. We had a poll. It was kind of an independent poll that was done at school right before mock convention about who you would vote for as president or which party you would support. And I was really shocked to see that the professors were overall a very liberal, democratic thinking group. And it was a mirror image in terms of votes. The professors all, you know, 80-85% were Democrats, and the students were 80-85% Republicans. Just never knew that. Of course, I never had many political discussions with the professors. So they were more liberal than the student body, and I think they were really enthusiastic about seeing students expand their horizons, you know. And clubs and organizations and special interest groups helped to do that. And especially with the women, as soon as we spoke up about something, there were, you know, millions of people around to support it and help us out, and money and administration available to, you know, consult with us. And they were incredibly receptive. And I'd love to see a list of all the new organizations and things that have popped up, you know, in the last 5-10 years. And I always wonder if we're becoming all of a sudden more intellectual, more diverse, and more progressive, or if it's always been at the same rate, but it's just, you know, been at different times, and so obviously different levels of progression during those times.
It's better.
I would think so.
It's better.
Yeah.
How about minorities on campus?
You know, it's tough. I don't know if I would want to be a minority on campus, although I was as a woman, but certainly not at the level that other minorities face today. And I interview for the alumni admissions group in San Francisco, and I have to be perfectly honest with the people that I interviewed that are really interested, and that is to say it's an incredible place, but it's a conservative thinking place, and it's a homogeneous group of people. And being in the first class of women, I was able to help educate a lot of the student body, I think, about women and what we can contribute and how we're different and what our issues are. But it wasn't always just a coast, you know, a coasting sort of experience. There was uphill battles along the way. And I think all minorities face that. And if you're the sort of person that wants to go out there into, you know, an experience that's already kind of set in stone and you know exactly what you're going to get, then maybe WNL wouldn't be the place for you. If you think you want to take on the challenge of trying to promote, you know, a certain minority issue or working to assimilate, you know, or educate other people, then this is a better opportunity. But socially, I think it was hard. I had heard stories about minority groups not getting bids in fraternities because they were minority. I think that's changing somewhat, you know, but not across the board. And I think there were minority groups, and I'm sure that the administration in the school was as supportive as they could be, but they can only control the social acceptance so much. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, you know, just as it is in the South in general, there's some battles to fight, you know, and some prejudices to overcome.
Did you see any situations?
No, I didn't see any hostility. There were people that used language, you know, that I think was inappropriate. Most people would think is inappropriate. There were people that, you know, expressed opinions and views that I think was inappropriate. And it's because their families were that way. And, you know, I think it's just going to be a long time coming for some of those people before they re-educate themselves, or maybe several generations before there's more exposure to overcome sort of those prejudices. So it was there. I don't think I was as sensitive to it because I wasn't a minority, you know, in terms of racial minority or mm-hmm. ethnic minority, that sort of thing. But I would imagine that there were a lot of minority students who really were not very happy.
Yeah, I expect so.
And I
it
can
looks
also,
tough.
Yeah, I can also say I was a Jewish person, mm-hmm. and I'm not really a pious Jewish person, but I do remember being uncomfortable at times because I was Jewish and because there was sentiment that was anti-Semitic, you know.
And how do you respond to that?
Well, I think I get frustrated with the people that are going to, you know, live their life with blinders on. And I think that there were a lot of people who knew me before they knew I was Jewish, and then came to realize that maybe I wasn't a different person because I was Jewish. And I had some friends who said, you know, a good friend from Thomasville, and he said, I've just never known a Jewish person before, you know, and it's just a matter of exposure. It's not because, you know, he, for instance, was malicious or a hateful person. He just didn't know, and he had only heard things and maybe read things and needed the exposure. So, I was happy to be a Jewish person that didn't have to be perceived as Jewish and different, therefore, you know, maybe promoted some sort of assimilation there that might not have been otherwise. But if I were practicing Jewish, and avidly so, it might have been harder.
Were there still Jewish fraternities? At that point?
There
had been a couple
mm-hmm.
that were primarily Jewish.
ZBT, I think, had been. And
had it closed down by then?
It was still a fraternity that was active, but it wasn't a Jewish fraternity.
Mm.
It had just
mm-hmm.
kind of changed. And I seem to remember hearing that the percentage of Jewish people on campus is incredibly low, 2%. So they economically probably couldn't have survived.
Mm-hmm.
But, even the Christian people here, religion just wasn't a big, you know, facet of your life in college. And so religion is probably a little bit easier to get by than would be, you know, some of the other minorities, or that being a Black person or being an Asian person or that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's not quite as big a badge to wear.
No, it's not.
How about You, what would you like to talk about? I've been working down my list.
What would I like to talk about? It's just fun to sit here and talk about the experiences and what a great place it is. I would say, as I get older, I appreciate WNO more and more every day, every time I come back. And I come back now for the alumni board, and friends always say, oh, are your friends going to be there? Are you going to have a good time? And my friends aren't coming back for these reunion weekends. I'm with this group of WNO alumni that are older for the most part. And I enjoy it as much, and just from a different perspective. It's like I said, you know, spending time with people that all love the same things about WNL. And you will hear WNL alumni around the country say, it is just the greatest place. There is no place like it, you know. And I think that there's a big majority of people that really feel that way. And I don't know if everybody from every college feels that way. I doubt they do, you know. But we're lucky to have had the experience, and we realize it more and more. And it's this nice little isolated community that I think is hard to replicate outside of this community. And the honor code being, you know, a huge part of that, which was, I think, in full force and really effective while I was here.
Tell me about the honor system. What did it mean to you?
It was, it didn't mean a lot to me before I came. I mean, you know, you read about it, and I told you how much it worked and how important it was. You didn't really understand it until you saw it in effect. And sometimes it was a little bit too effective, because you got nervous sometimes about things you didn't need to be nervous about, you know, like you're taking a test and you look out the window and all of a sudden you're worried somebody's going to accuse you of cheating. Kind of could instill some fear. But it was just really a treat to be able to not worry about simple petty crime elements that I think, you know, were eliminated because the honor system was strong. It was just not acceptable for anybody to steal or lie or cheat, and the penalty for allowing that to occur, you know, having witnessed it and allowing it to occur, was almost as bad as doing it yourself. And so it was just a very positive sort of peer pressure that infiltrated the campus. And I don't know how they managed to maintain it, because, you know, you do have so many people from different, you know, that come in with their own kind of set of values and things that are acceptable and not acceptable. But if you see an honor trial, it's a really severe experience. Have you seen one?
No. Tell me about it.
It's a very severe experience, and it's not a game. It's not taken lightly. I think the executive committee takes the job very seriously, and in hearing, I think getting complaints, or somebody must have to file, you know, some sort of complaint, and then they will do a closed hearing and determine if it looks like it is a legitimate complaint, a breach of the honor code. And then if they do that and find the person not guilty, then it's said and done with. If that person is found guilty at that point, they can withdraw on their own, or they can choose to go through an open trial where it's open to the student body. And it takes, you know, weeks and months sometimes. There are witnesses up there speaking for and against the person. There are character witnesses, there are people from outside the university that come in. You're defended by a law student, you know, if you're a defense on the defense, and the prosecutors are prosecuting as would attorneys. And it's not a mock convention, and it's not a mock trial. And, you know, it's humiliating. I couldn't imagine going through it. And even if you're found not guilty, I think that there's a big scar, you know, that you live with after that. And then to be found guilty and leave, you know, and I don't know how you'd ever recover from that in terms of applying for jobs and applying to another school. But I think it's just such a big price to pay that people really don't fool around with it. And that's in addition to the peer pressure that's the positive one. Or not.
You wouldn't know that, though, as a freshman coming in.
No, you wouldn't. But we do hear about it a lot. Like, the white book is sacred. And it's, like I said, it didn't mean much to me. I read it. UVA's got an honor code, you know, and I don't think that the UVA students appreciate it in anywhere near the same terms that we do. But you hear about it, and it's promoted again and again, and then you start seeing some of the benefits that come out of it, such as you know, not having strict supervision when you take your exams and that sort of thing. And, you know, sometimes in high school, I think cheating rings happen and can be acceptable. And as a young person, you sometimes don't realize, you know, the nature of what you're doing or the breach of integrity of what's going on. But when you get here and there's just a very severe approach, and it's a very serious issue, and somehow that's infiltrated from the administration to the upperclassmen straight through the student body, and it's becomes something. I mean, you would never know, as I said, you know, if you knew somebody cheating, you would really have to go through some long deliberations to not turn them in. Just, it became natural. It was strange, and I don't know how they do it. But most alumni would say the same thing. It's just another unique aspect of WNL.
So obviously you attended some hearing.
I did.
And that was real hard?
I had one of my roommates went through a trial, and she was found not guilty. And unfortunately, there are some situations, too, where, you know, it's people can breach the honor code when they don't mean to, you know, and certain things that have thought to be acceptable, like paraphrasing other people's work, when you were told, a professor had told them to refer to other reports that had been done, and for that professor, we typically paraphrased quotes from books and chapters that he assigned to us, so he would know that we read the chapter for the most part. Mm-hmm. And there, she did some paraphrasing from another person's work, brought it in a report. They reported it, became an honor violation for plagiarism.
The faculty reported it?
Another student mm-hmm. reported it. Mm-hmm. And so we went through that process. And the roommates didn't know about it during the closed trial. Obviously, it was very personal. And it was also something that you didn't want the student body to know about. And for reasons that were just that it was, I'm losing my thought here. It was just a sensitive issue, and during the investigation, it couldn't leak out. And so I can remember her family calling in the middle of the night, her kind of having to go. They had midnight hearings. It was really unusual. And then she told us that she was found guilty, went to an open trial. And it was humiliating. And I don't know how you're supposed to go about your studies, you know, when you go through something like that, having the stress, the time that it took to deal with it. She would leave campus for weeks at a time to kind of be with her family and get away from things. And even at the non-guilty verdict, the entire chapel roared with applause. She's a popular person, and I think felt that, you know, her intent was not to lie or steal or cheat. But I think it was a scar that she still struggles with. You know, she never fully felt comfortable again. She felt like a lot of people out there thought she was a cheater. You know, she had sometimes thought that she was being targeted because she was a woman. She was the first woman to go through a trial. So it was a really emotional experience for her. And as I said, something I think she's continued to struggle with and probably makes her remember WNL and not as strong a light as a result. And that's the downside of a honor code, just like there's a downside of a legal system, you know.
So this event took place in Lee Chapel?
Oh, yes.
Well, that loads it all the more.
Yes. I mean, just bringing it almost to a sacrilegious sort of level. And I assume they still do them there. So you are up there on stage next to the great general, you know. Body, it's very severe. And you know, you're right, freshmen don't know about it, but when you see a trial, it all of a sudden becomes very clear. And I think there are so many trials a year, 6 to 8 or so.
Did many people attend?
Yes. And this was visible because she was a woman and the first woman, and she was also very popular. And there people came throughout. It's interesting. You know, it's just like people line up to see an O.J. Simpson trial. You know, it's just interesting to see how it works and to understand the issues. And people like to make the decision themselves. And the jury is a random group of students, you know, so you are judged by your peers. And that's hard. And by the final verdict, it was packed or standing room only, you know, and it erupted in applause when she was found not guilty. But and there are so few open trials a year that I think the fascination level is intensified and people really come out to see the whole thing happen.
Well, I saw some time ago there was a very small notice in the Ringtone 5 that a student had withdrawn. And it was just very quiet as far as I know. Does that happen very often?
Probably a little more often than we realize because it is not publicized. I'm surprised it was in the Ringtone 5 because I don't remember them publicizing that in the past.
It was just a very... I think it was there. Or maybe did I see it on a bulletin board? Somewhere there was a notice and it was just a single sentence and it was loaded.
I think partially the intent is that person is given the opportunity to withdraw on their own accord and not have this, you know, be a mark on their transcript certainly and, you know, theoretically their character. But we always, if somebody withdrew and there was somebody that you knew, you'd hear about it. First of all, they were gone. Second of all, it just, you know, friends, it would leak and stuff. But I don't think it was an unusually large number of people, you know, and I think, but maybe a little bit larger number of people than actually went to trial. But I would guess, you know, 8 a year of those and maybe 4 to 6 trials a year. I don't know what I would do if I were in the situation. Even if I, you know, knew I was not guilty, I don't know what I would do.
Yeah, it's an intense thing to lay on young people.
And it's strange, you know, to have students being the prosecutors. You know, it's here you have, I don't know where they get the wherewithal to know how to prosecute a trial. You know, it's interesting.
It's not all law students?
No, the prosecutors, the student body tends to be undergraduates for the most part, just because you have more undergraduates voting. So it's kind of interesting.
Did you get involved in student government at all?
I didn't, and that just kind of wasn't my forte. But there were some women that did, and the first woman, there was people voted against her because she was a woman.
I was real surprised at the elections, how many women were running and were elected. Impressive numbers.
Now I think it's a different story, but yeah, at the time, no. There were a couple women and they were voted against because they were women, but obviously as people got used to seeing women candidates and listening to what they were saying, it started to think that it made sense.
Well, politics seems to be a real serious thing around here, just in general.
It's funny. Everybody's got an opinion, don't they?
Just all kinds of politics, yeah. Especially local politics.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing that strikes me on this campus is the speaking tradition. Was that fully in force? And because what I understand, it's been revived more lately. Was it in full force when you were here?
As a freshman, I don't remember hearing as much about it, the speaking tradition, and being educated about it. Maybe it happened naturally. It happened a little bit naturally. But as an alumna, I hear about it more. And I think it has been revived. And probably the speaking tradition was a natural sort of function for people, and then it became called a speaking tradition because everybody spoke. And, you know, you don't want to have to get to a point where you have to promote a speaking tradition, but obviously people have forgotten about it and we're having to promote it again. But I think I got caught in that little lull where people just, it wasn't promoted and people forgot about it and didn't necessarily practice it. So it wasn't there, but I do remember being friendly and all the hellos and the nods on campus, but I just don't remember feeling like you had to say it to everybody that you passed, and now I guess that's probably where we are again.
Pretty much.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful thing, you know, I love it, and I've noticed since I've been back, there's plenty of nodding and smiling and speaking going on.
That's very charming. Well, I know you have to get on to your meeting.
What time is it?
It's a little after 1.
Yes, I do. But
thank you.
Thank you for interviewing
me
and everyone else.
It's an honor to talk to you.
Thank you. Are you just collecting tapes and tapes of information?
We're working on a book.
Yeah.